Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. I hope we never take it for granted here in Vermont what our small state and approachable government allows for. And that is probably the most direct connection between our politicians and their constituents. Having lived in Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Florida, all swing states, I know that we have here not only with our citizen legislature, but all levels of government, and it's pretty incredible. And for the next half hour, State Treasurer Beth Pierce is with us. We're going to discuss the role of the treasurer, as well as several other issues that she's been working on. Treasurer Pierce, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Well, thank you very much, Rick. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. Listeners, if you'd like to ask Treasurer Pierce a question, you can give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Beth Pierce, I want to spend a little time talking about the role of treasurer because it is now your 10th anniversary in the position. I know you spent 8 years as deputy treasurer for the state, and then you were originally appointed to the position when Jeb Spaulding was chosen by Governor Shumlin to be his Secretary of Administration. So that happened pretty quickly. Were you surprised by the sudden change, and were you ready?
From a perspective of knowledge base on the Treasurer's Office, having spent 8 years as a deputy, certainly had some sense of what the issues were. Prior to that, was a deputy in another state. I've had 40, it's hard to count these days, but 43, 44 years.
You better be able to count.
There you go. But the years, 43, 44 years in government finance. So I think that I've dealt with the task. What I had not done was run for office. I don't think you would count me running for town meeting member in my hometown when I was either 20 or 22. I don't think that's quite the same. So it was a new experience for me. And I had a little bit of reservation with it. I love it. It's the best job in the state. I enjoy working with folks on a variety of issues, whether it's clean water, unclaimed property. We've done some work in the housing area. We've have a program called ABLE, Achieving a Better Life Experience, which is a program for individuals with disabilities to save for the future. We're working right now on implementing something called the Green Mountain Secure Retirement Plan, which will provide a retirement benefit for people that work with employers that are 50 or less employees and that signed up for the program to provide some retirement options for those individuals. And small businesses are the backbone of Vermont, and we're really pleased to be able to get this program off the ground.
In the decade in this position, what would you say have been your most important accomplishments?
Well, I think that we've had a lot of work on fiscal discipline. We've got our debt in order. Putting money on your credit card, there are times when you need to do it, but you also need to be careful, and I think we've had some discipline there. We've worked on pension issues, and I think we've done some good things, very good things. If you take a look at what's happened since 2010 and projecting out to 2038, which is the year under statute that the pension liabilities need to be retired. All in, all the initiatives that we've done with our partners, the General Assembly, the governor, $1.5 billion in savings. That's something that we're very proud of. Clean water, we're also very proud of. But getting back to the pensions, with all that work, and nonetheless, we are it has been a painful process to go through the recommendations that we've had to make this past year.
And Treasurer Pierce, I want to ask you about the responsibilities of the state treasurer. I'm always amazed every time, for instance, you talk about clean water, that falls under your purview. So I think people would be surprised. What are the responsibilities of the state treasurer?
Sure. Well, the basic functions are we are the state's banker. So we take in the dollars that tax dollars that come in, fee dollars that come in, and based on warrants prepared by financial management, consistent with the budget, we pay out the bills. We invest the dollars that are available that aren't needed to be expended on a given day. So we invest those dollars. Right now, I have to say that interest rates across the country for treasuries and money market funds are pretty low. Mm-hmm. But we're hoping that changes down the road. We manage the debt for the state. We provide a report to the governor and to the General Assembly, the legislature, on how much money we think is appropriate to bond for. And again, we've tried to lower that over the years. That's done through a committee called the Capital Debt Affordability Advisory Committee, CDAC. I'm chair, but we've got some wonderful members that work on that. We manage unclaimed property, and we've just started our campaign for this year in May. In fact, if you listen on DEV today, you'll hear some ads.
Oh, excellent.
We're getting that campaign moving so that people have an opportunity to claim the dollars that they may have forgotten about, whether it's a uncashed check or insurance proceeds they didn't receive, a utility deposit. We want people to get those dollars. And so we're starting our advertisement today for our – we do one in May and in November. We also do fairs. We're looking forward now that we're getting past some of the issues on COVID that we can do the Champlain Valley Expo this year. So we're looking to find ways. It's a consumer protection issue, making sure that people get those dollars. Businesses are not allowed to keep those dollars. They have to remit those to the state, and then we try to find the rightful owner. And we've been very successful. We're usually in the top five across the country in terms of disbursements as a percentage of receipts. I want to get to one. I'm a very competitive person with my fellow treasurers, but we're going to continue to work on that. West Virginia tends to be number one. What can I say?
Oh, wow.
But we also manage the retirement division. So if you're looking to retire, you talk to our counselors. We get you on payroll so that you do get a retirement benefit. This past summer, we have four counselors and additional staff for making the payments and getting things processed. But we processed just about 500 retirements in the month of July and did it in the middle of COVID. We had all sorts of ways and methods to reach out to people that were thinking about retirement, do some counseling there. And I think that the folks over there deserve a lot of credit for getting that done. We manage the staff here for a number of functions, including investments, but we do not make the investment decision. That is a decision of the Vermont Pension Investment Committee. Tom Galanka is chair, and I have to tell you, he's been chair for about 4 years, and he has made such a difference in the way that we're moving forward on our investments. So we've got a lot of different duties. We get involved with programs like ABLE because it's about savings. Mm-hmm. We do a financial literacy program to support that, plus the Green Mountain Secure Retirement Plan. So we get involved in a number. Those are financial literacy, pretty much a core responsibility of the treasurer's office. Clean water, housing. We get involved in those when the legislature asks us to do that. I always joke that I was not in the room when I volunteered for the clean water report. We had 23 public meetings with over, I believe, over 1,000 people participating when we did our report. And while the results weren't exactly what we were looking for, the funding levels are, and I think that we were able to have a difference in working on our clean water initiatives. And we're looking to do more in the housing area, frankly. And for me, homelessness is a big issue, and we want to look at ways we can assist with the financing so that everyone in Vermont has an opportunity for a lifetime of financial well-being.
Now, you mentioned that you are the state's banker. In the past, there was talk about creating a state bank, which never seemed to gain traction. So I wanted to get an idea if that was something that made sense, that we should look into, maybe the pros and cons of what a state bank would mean for Vermont.
Sure. Well, good question. The sound bites are great, keeping the money in Vermont and the like. It's really – the sound bites are great. But it doesn't work. Only one state has had a successful state bank, and that's North Dakota, and that was I don't remember the date. I think it was someplace around 1919 or something in that range that they implemented that. North Dakota back in that day is a little different than Vermont. Delaware had one that wasn't successful, and in the 80s fell apart based on some bad loans. The big issue is capitalization of it, and it would take a great deal of money to do that. We don't think that it's the right move for Vermont, but we listened, and I think that's important in the Treasurer's office. As we move forward on these pension issues, again, the thing that we need to do is listen. But we created something called the Local Investment Committee, and we worked with legislature to create that. And so we put 10%, it's called 10% in Vermont, 10% of our dollars, our average cash position, and that's well over $300 million, about $330 million. And we put 10% of that into local investments, whether it's housing, which is a big part of it, energy, energy efficiency projects, projects for energy renewal as well, funding, bridge funding for housing. And we've been very successful with this program. We get a decent rate of return for the taxpayer, and we keep those dollars in Vermont. And I think that's the idea behind a state bank. I think that this is a model that more appropriately works for Vermont, but attempts to accomplish the same thing.
And Treasurer Pierce, time to talk about that unclaimed property program. First of all, how much money is there, and where did it all come from?
Well, right now, when we did the ads, it was $99 million, and we're now passing the $100 million mark, so it continues to grow. Unclaimed property is any type of financial asset that someone lost track of, perhaps a CD that they forgot about, certificate of deposit, or property that was not previously returned to the owner. One of those might be life insurance proceeds that the individual was not aware that he or she was a beneficiary. Property, as I said, can include those, but by law, companies, businesses, nonprofits do not get to keep those funds. They need to send those to the state, and then we go out and work to find the individuals and give back that money. And it's really about consumer protection. This past year, we've had a successful program. Despite COVID, we did 12,544 claims, $4.7
million. Wow.
The previous year, about 17,600 claims. It will vary from year to year. I think this year we saw a little reduction with COVID, or perhaps in 2020 there was a jump as folks were looking for their dollars. We have a new feature this year, and that's a paperless claim form. So you can claim, I believe it's under $200. You can file online. And if you submit that claim, we will issue a check the next day. And we think that this is a very good step in terms of the environment and in terms of customer service. And we hope to be able to take one more step, which is to process electronic payments as much as we can and get rid of those paper checks as well.
Well, I have to tell you, Treasurer Pierce, I used it yesterday.
Yes.
And in the past, I found that I had, it was just such a minimal amount. It's like under $2. So right now, this massive amount, this $100 million, has just dropped by $2. Because in the past, you'd have to fill it out and send it back in. I said, oh, it's not worth it to me for the $2. But I went in yesterday, tried the new feature, and for, you know, anything under $200, it totally makes sense. It goes quickly and easily, and I'm hoping that you're, you know, rolling out that big check sometime today to me.
Well, again, if you put it in one day, that if the next day the check runs happen, and it will, as they say, the check is in the mail, but it really is.
Yeah, and for me, just to give listeners an idea of, you know, how kooky, this could be, you know, something you totally forget about. I don't know how many years ago, there was a bit of an online farmer's market deal, and you put in, I don't know, maybe $35 increments, right? And I used all but, you know, somewhere around $2, and then totally forgot about it, left it be, and you found it and returned it to me. So thank you very much.
Well, that's great. You know, we had a retired teacher some years ago that we called, and she called me back, and I said, yes, you have some money. And she said, how much? And I said, $150,200 or something, and 18 cents. I remember the 18 cents. And there was a pause on the other side, and could you repeat that, please? And she was a teacher for a few years in Connecticut. She got out of college, and she when she got her retirement funds back, she put that in a stock fund and forgot about it. And we have reciprocal agreements with other states, so Connecticut sent it to us. And over those years, she was had spent 30-plus years as a teacher here, was in retirement, and we were thrilled to give her that money.
Wow. So how old can some of these assets be that you're holding, Treasurer Pierce?
They can be 30-plus years old. It's harder to track those, obviously. The databases weren't developed as they are now, but you never lose the right to claim that money, and that's an important piece of this. It's yours, and we want to try to find you.
Wow, no time limit. If it's over a certain amount, does the recipient owe tax on it?
Well, it depends on the. We say go talk to your accountant because it depends on the type of property. Some of those properties have already been reported to the IRS. Before they were remitted to us, for instance, maybe interest on a deposit has already been reported. So we recommend that you talk to your accountant. I'm not too worried about the $2, you should probably have a conversation, for instance, about stock proceeds and things along that line.
And are all of these are they all dollars? Sometimes, you know, is it an asset that could be a physical asset?
Well, it's all financial assets with one exception, which are safety deposit boxes with banking institutions, and we get those. It's kind of interesting what you have in those safety deposit boxes. It can be a ring. One time we filed the invoice for a very expensive sports car. I don't know.
Well, that was
who
mine.
Might be. There you go. One of the more notable years ago was a series of the bank called it pictures, and it was a series of notebooks. And what they were various artists, composers, musicians, and would have a picture of maybe the artwork, and then a letter for the person or a signature. So we had a letter from Grandma Moses about thanking somebody for paint. We had Brahms, notes from Brahms. We had Matisse. We had a variety of different pieces. And we were able to track the individual because he was a volunteer firefighter. And the town clerk remembered him from working in that town. He was retired, and I believe, in Florida at that point. When he came back up to Vermont, we were able to give them that. And the collection was one of a third piece of that, one of them being with the Columbia University and another part with one of the New York museums. So It was really exciting to give that back.
Well, let's make sure people understand how they can find if they have an asset that the state is holding and how they can get that back.
Sure. Well, you can check our website to begin with. It's missingmoney.vermont.gov. And you can do searches in that situation. You can also give us a call, 1-800-642-3191. And you can also email us, we'd be happy to take that information and work with you. We are taking calls. We are open for business despite COVID. Mm-hmm. The staff are taking those calls and then in some cases working from home. We have staff in here at intermittent periods, but we will call you back within one business day. So we're trying very hard to find every way to continue this program through the COVID issues. We're very happy and want to give you that money. So please check out our website. And again, it's missingmoney.vermont.gov.
Excellent. Now, with the time we have left, we have about 3 minutes. I want to make sure we talk again about the pension reform report. I did get an email from Tom who asks, why is this all of a sudden becoming an issue? This has been, you know, something that's been festering in Vermont for quite a while. I know in the 10 years that you've been treasurer, you have brought this up numerous times, but what has been going on, say, over the last decade when it comes to this this pension problem that we have, this major unfunded debt?
certainly. Well, we continue to have defined benefit plans, and I believe that those are the best plans, the best bang for the buck for the taxpayer and the retiree. So that you put your money in, the employer puts their money in, we invest those dollars, and you have a retirement at the end of your career, and I think that's very important. This past year, we did some true up of some of our assumptions, and also you see different experience. The teacher system, for instance, besides the lack of funding that it had from 1990 to 2007, and also the lack of funding of the health care, which is part of that up to 2014, we ended up with a situation where we had $604 million increase in the liabilities and a $97 million in increase in the retiree share. The other piece that the teacher system, for instance, we've had a lot of retirements, turnover of staff. Some of that may be related recently to COVID, but I think it's also related to some of the organizational changes and budget pressures at the local level and having an impact on retirement. So we have a study that we produced and sent over options to the General Assembly. We were hoping, frankly, that they'd get that done this year. I think that that would be very important. It did not happen. And to me, that means we got another year of $97 million of payments that could have been used for social service needs. There's no win-win in this one. There are no winners. In addition, it puts more pressure on the system. By late 2030s, we expect that we will be paying $500 million, $500 million for these liabilities, and we need to take action now. The legislature did not move on this issue. We're disappointed in that, and now we're left with more or less a consolation result, and that's the convening of a task force. But we're concerned. The proposed task force on the House side does not bode well for success. It's too large. The timelines are very unrealistic. And most important, it does not include an equal number of employee group representation. And if you're going to solve the problem, you need people at the table to work together. And I think that for us, we see the Senate version as a better alternative. We're hopeful to get this going this year. We'd rather have solved the situation now, but if you're going to move into essentially a study committee or a task force, let's get it right, and let's get it right now.
Well done. State Treasurer Beth Pierce, thank you so much for spending time with us again.
My pleasure, and thank you very much for all you do, and thank you for advertising our unclaimed property.
Oh, absolutely. I'm happy to get my check. All right, we're going to get caught up on national news with a CBS News update. When we return, Nick Bennett of the Vermont Mountain Biking Association will join us, and this is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Sengary. May is National Bike Month, celebrating communities all across the country as a way to share the many benefits of bicycling and to encourage more people to hop on and pedal off. Here in Vermont, the Vermont Mountain Biking Association is one of the largest mountain bike advocacy groups in the country. Its mission is to ensure the sustainable future of mountain biking in Vermont and to thoughtfully promote the best riding in the Northeast by serving as the central hub for advocacy, education, and event support. VIMBA, it's called, and their new executive director is Nick Bennett. He's here to tell us about their work and upcoming projects. Nick, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks for having me.
Listeners, if you've got a question for Nick or if you want to share why you love mountain biking, give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Nick, give us an idea of what VIMBA is.
No, that's a great question. So VIMBA is an association, essentially an amalgam of 27 local chapters throughout the state. So presently, or at least last year, we had over 7,600 members, and those were spread out from, Chittenden in the north all the way down south to some of our border with Massachusetts. What we do and what we are, essentially, we provide the operational support for all those chapters. So we do the back end. We have a membership platform. We provide insurance and kind of ensure that those local chapters can do trail building and maintenance and community engagement. And then we, as well as the centralized sort of organization, we're responsible for advocacy and for ensuring that there's no undue regulation on landowners and that policies at the state level are promoting mountain biking statewide.
You know, I want to back up a moment. We throw out numbers, and sometimes, we just kind of let them swing by. But in a state the size of Vermont, with 27 chapters and 7,600 members, those are robust numbers. How long have you been around?
So I've only been in Vermont. I came from Washington State, and it's a great point. So I've been here just since the turn of the year. I was actually hired and brought on in March as the new executive director, but you're totally right. So the state that I come from, Washington State, we have a similar size association of about 8,000 members. But in Washington State, you've got 12 times as many people and 7 times as much land. So in Vermont, when you think about the fact that there, and this year will be well over 8,000 members, that's over 1% of Vermont's population are active members of our mountain bike advocacy organization.
All right, I'm impressed. Sometimes I just let numbers run right by me, and you kind of stop me in my tracks there. How many miles of trails are known about and maintained by your group?
Yeah, so over the last 10 or so years, we're now at about 1,400 miles of trails that have been built and are maintained actively by a VIMBA chapter, and that's grown. I mean, every year we add between dozens and, typically in the neighborhood of dozens of miles of trail throughout the state.
All right. So I'm guessing that with 7,600 members, you must have an idea that there's a lot more. How popular is mountain biking? Has it become in Vermont?
Yeah, it's a great point. So it's immensely popular. I think we saw last year when folks really realized how essential outdoor recreation was throughout the state, we saw trailheads from, the very north to the very south really get, not necessarily overcrowded, but, the numbers that we saw in many cases, parking lots were full and the capacity of trails were really challenged in many cases. So while we're at, that number above 1% of the state's population, which is in some cases mind-boggling to think about, I do think there's room to grow. I'd imagine that we could easily see double that number of active members. And then there are plenty of folks that maybe they just get out on their mountain bike once or twice a year. And today, this month, as you mentioned, is National Bike Month, and it's a great opportunity for folks that might have a mountain bike that just commute back and forth to work to take that side trail off the bike path and do a little bit of dirt or single track and kind of just get out and sample it. So I think there's actually a huge number of folks that, either on the weekends or here and there, do get out into the woods on a bike. But in terms of active members, I think despite that significant penetration, we actually do have some room to grow.
Now, in a non-COVID year, I'm going to talk about attracting people from out of state. But, I mean, we know skiing does that. We know snowmobiling does that. What kind of, lure can this be? And I know the folks up in the Northeast Kingdom Trails definitely talk about this. But what kind of lure can mountain biking be for the state of Vermont for having visitors come in from out of state?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think one of the things we love about mountain biking, we really view our mission, and you teed it up originally, but, one is to create recreational opportunities for communities within and outside the state of Vermont. Secondly, is really this idea to promote town and rural economies throughout the state. So what a great thing about mountain biking and having these 27 chapters spread throughout the state is that there are opportunities to really drive economic development from, and as you brought up the Northeast Kingdom, I mean, now East Berkshire is over 130,000 visitors annually come to their communities, and they've grown in a way that they've really tried to encourage those dollars to come in and support lodging, to support local businesses, and to try to stand up and drive economic development in that community. So if we think about regionally, one of the things that we're doing now, particularly as we start to come out of COVID, is working with other regional organizations. We have the New England Mountain Bike Association that operates in New Hampshire, Maine, and Massachusetts. We have other regional groups in New York, really understanding how we can not necessarily even encourage, because we know certainly before COVID, we had tons of folks coming into Vermont from outside the state who were spending time on our trails, but who weren't necessarily spending time, or at least members of VIMBA, or necessarily spending money at those trail locations and communities. So we're really trying to encourage that and provide opportunities. One of the really neat projects we have related to that is this project called the Velomont, which is this vision that we've been working on the past couple of years to essentially create a continuous single track or predominantly single track trail from north to south Vermont, similar to what the Long Trail serves for, for hiking. And that could see up to 65,000 annual visitors along that trail network. And it's one that would be, essentially the idea would be it would daisy chain between rural communities and really drive a lot of economic development in those areas.
Now, I think of this as a summer activity, but you're probably going to tell me I'm very wrong with your next answer.
No, I mean, you're not. I think 5 years ago, that was totally right. I mean, we look at, and now it's kind of great that May is National Biking Month, because it's really the month that we tend to start to really open up our trail networks, because we have to get through, for the dirt at least, the winter and then mud season before trails are really suitable for tires. But then it typically extends into November. What we've seen in the last couple of years, and it's a phenomenal opportunity for Vermont, is the explosion and growth of fat biking. So trail networks throughout the state have been converting over in the winter months to with hard pack trails. Kingdom Trail has been doing this really well, but we have them throughout the state that support these bicycles that have wider tires at lower pressure, so you can go and cruise trails, you know, essentially all year long. You might have to take a month off in the fall for things to the snow to hit the ground, and then a month off in the spring for mud season. But other than that, I mean, it's almost become a year round activity.
You've mentioned 27 chapters of VIMBA around the state now. How does a chapter form?
It's a great question. So we really view ourselves as a kind of grassroots, bottom-up organization. So typically it takes place when a couple of individuals in an area decide that they either have some trails that have been loosely maintained or maybe haven't been maintained well, or they want to create a new trail system in their area. And so it starts with them engaging their community and maybe doing some trail maintenance on their own, and eventually they get to a size where they realize, well, we'd like to have insurance. We might need to have a payroll. We might need to hire somebody to do some work. We'd like to be involved in an organization that's bigger and can speak up, you know, loudly for us at the state level. And then they reach out to us and say, hey, we've heard about VIMBA. We're interested in becoming a chapter. And then because we've now, you know, as you know, over 24 chapters across the state, we have a pretty good handle on how to help those communities or those small organizations begin to grow. And we have a couple now that have only been around a year or two. Some may not actually have any official trail yet, but we've been able to help accelerate that process to where they'll be building trail and growing over the next couple of years. And what's interesting, too, is that we have these over 24 chapters, but not every chapter is the same. We have chapters like Fellowship of the Wheel that has well over 1,000 members in Chittenden County. They're very large, and they oversee several trail networks. And we have other chapters that are small, and they kind of like to stay that way. They're more community-focused. They're less, you know, either less trying to sort of pull folks in from outside, but they do want that support and infrastructure so they can develop trails for their community. So we're very open. We don't have a roadmap that says to be a chapter, you must grow or you must, you know, do certain X, Y, or Z. We just try to support those organizations and allow them to really focus on building and maintaining trail.
I'm speaking with Nick Bennett. He's the executive director of the Vermont Mountain Bike Association, or VIMBA. Nick, what are some recent projects VIMBA has been involved in?
Yeah, it's a great question. So there's so many, honestly. So we've seen, it's hard to almost enumerate them, but if you look kind of up, down throughout the state, a lot of what we do is really on trail maintenance. So as I noted, we've got those 1,400 miles to take care of. So every year, and you'll see this May, there's really been a big focus on getting back out after the winter and doing trail maintenance. So that's the least glamorous work that we, that we take part in, which is just the upkeep of those trails. It takes a lot of effort, and one of the big things that our organization focuses on as well is environmental stewardship. So when we get out into the woods in the spring each year, we take a hard look and understand how our trails draining, how is the usage sort of unfolded, and spending a lot of time just maintaining that existing network. One of the areas that we've been working on lately in some of our networks, the Stowe Trails Partnership up in Stowe has been very recently, last couple of weeks, really focused on this, is ensuring that there's a sufficient number, or at least more adaptive-friendly trails. So folks that get out on like hand cycles and bicycles that sort of aren't the conventional two-wheeled bicycles, but three- or four-wheeled versions, ensuring that there are trails in every network that are available for those individuals. So that's been a big effort over the past couple of years, is converting. Oftentimes that means widening trails or adapting bridges to support those three- and four-wheeled bicycles. And then the big project that we've really been putting a lot of energy into the last while here is the Velomont, which is run by a group called the Velomont Trail Collective, which is part of VIMBA. But they've spent a lot of time and energy developing what will be this, we're hoping, a legacy project that will establish Vermont and really ensure that it takes its rightful place as a sort of pillar of mountain biking in the country, and one that, you know, if we see that actually take place, we'll have close to 500 miles of continuous trail. It'll create close to 85,000 acres in new conservation opportunities, and we'll actually touch, by linking through the state, 23 VIMBA chapters. So we view that as a really interesting sort of opportunity for connective tissue to be established sort of tip to tail in Vermont.
Is there a timeline on that, Valamont, that you're kind of saying we're looking at this being?
Yeah, it's not going to be overnight. So we're looking through 2025 for this first phase, and that's going to put about 200 miles of that 500-mile trail network in state, and that's contingent upon funding and permissions and a lot of other things. But that would be the first phase that would really start to seed it, and we're viewing that really as like a 10-year project. It's something we want to do right, and we want to do it working closely and carefully with the communities that are involved, and then ensuring that becomes truly something that's embraced by all those areas of touch. But that's definitely going to be – that's a long-game plan for VIMBA.
Nick, one of the aspects of mountain biking that's highlighted on your website is building grit, focus, self-reliance, and character in kids. So how do you get young riders interested in mountain biking?
Yeah, that's a great question. So one of the things we've done over the past couple of years is really encourage chapters to build what we call progressive trail networks. And what that means is networks that have beginner, intermediate, and advanced trails. For a long time, Vermont was known as a place that had really challenging mountain bike trails, but kind of lacked that beginner-friendly set of networks. So we've actually done, and almost all the chapters have done an excellent job, so where parents can take their kids out, get on trail that's really, you know, inviting, not too challenging, and gets kids into the woods, but also that provides opportunities as those kids get better and more advanced to sort of step up their game as they go. And so that's something I've seen. You know, I used to spend a ton of time in Vermont before I moved to Washington, and coming back after 10 years, I just saw a totally transformed landscape in that regard. So that's a huge piece of it, is on the riding side. And then the other piece of it to really get kids involved is that we view ourselves partly as a riding organization, but really importantly as a building organization. We typically see about 30,000 volunteer hours a year go into trail building and maintenance. So with those efforts, we really try to set up trail days that are family friendly, encourage chapters to reach out and ensure that kids are getting out in the woods and, you know, swinging a hoe or, you know, raking a trail. And I've been out there already this season with my 8-year-old, and it's a blast when you get out there in the woods with, you know, not just the adults, but a couple of kids can get together and see the importance of giving back to their community, of creating these recreational assets together. And it's a ton of fun. And then that makes them even more committed. They're psyched to go then back out and ride, you know, that trail that they just helped either refurbish or put in. So I think that idea of really engaging kids and creating opportunities for them to participate at their level has been really essential for us.
Nick, I have this image of mountain biking, you know, hitting a root or a big rock and crashing, you know, going into a tree. I want to know, and I'm sure there's parents out there or spouses, you know, when their spouse says, hey, I'm going to go mountain biking, how safe is mountain biking really now, Nick?
It's a great question. I mean, it's one where I've never broken a bone mountain biking, but I don't know if that's a fair single data point. But no, I mean, it's the kind of thing where, as I mentioned before, those progressive trail networks, it's really designed now to where if you're a beginner and you can go find a green circle trail, I mean, it's the opportunities there are designed not to be super challenging and to get folks really comfortable. So having trails that are really at the level of users, particularly newer users, has been really important. And we don't see very many injuries, or at least that, you know, we hear too much about. You do see certainly people take a tumble and a spill here and there, but as you noted earlier with kids, that idea of building grit, I mean, that's part of mountain biking as well, is it does toughen you up, and there is a certain level of you know, rough and tumble nature to a degree. But I think having those trail systems that are appropriately leveled is one that's been really important. Then the other factor that's been a huge development in the last 5 years, really 10 years, is the quality of mountain bikes. So a new mountain bike today, particularly if you get one that has dual suspension, has shock absorbers front and rear, has geometry designed to really put the rider in a position that leaves them much better capable of handling technical features. It's night and day if you get on a bike, a modern mountain bike versus one 10 years ago, the degree of control and comfort and ease of avoiding those type of unfortunate crashes and stuff is really just night and day compared to where it was a few years ago.
Can you talk about VIMBA's focus on diversity, inclusion, and equity, and also the efforts to recognize indigenous land in Vermont?
No, yeah, absolutely. So our VIMBA recognized, even before the reckoning that really came to a boil last summer, that we had an obligation to be a more inviting community. There's a stereotype with mountain biking that, you know, doesn't it really include all groups, and that's one where we actively as an organization wanted to take a hard look at. And so the first thing is really being committed to ensure that anybody interested in experiencing Vermont mountain biking has the opportunity. So we've done that by seeking out partnerships with organizations that promote diversity, equity, and inclusion, and really understanding we're still at a phase where we're trying to have those conversations and understand how best we can support those groups. And the challenge with diversity is that it encompasses all different kinds of groups. There are groups for whom cultural issues have excluded, folks from being involved. And I think about there's been recent developments in engaging women more actively in the sport. We're still not at an equity level there, but we've accomplished a lot. But the challenges there are different than for BIPOC communities, where in many cases economic barriers or even geographic barriers that separate trails from communities are more significant. So the solutions or the tax we have to take are different there, and we're exploring ways we can do that through bike share programs, through helping support trail building or even bike parks or skills areas that are embedded in more areas of density that are not common to where you see mountain bikers. So that's been a big piece of it. One of the things that VIMBA's done as well is we have this thing called a What Does a Rider Look Like campaign on our website, where we try to tell the stories of mountain bikers that may not be typical in terms of what people expect when they think of the stereotypical mountain biker. So they're really embracing that image and trying to show that everybody is invited and everyone can be involved. But a lot of it, I mean, we're still, I would say, and, you know, it's something that I've come to understand, we're still working on it. It's one that we will always be working on. It's not work that will be done, but it takes the first step is really having those conversations and listening and understanding of how we can best support, and then working with groups that are at the front lines of DEI work to try to cooperate and be as productive and helpful as we can.
And what are you most excited about for the upcoming cycling season?
I think what I'm most excited about is what everybody is most excited about, which is the likelihood, and, you know, we're headed there trajectory-wise, that things can really open up meaningfully back again. The guidance we just got on Friday regarding outdoor mask wearing is a huge benefit. We actually have events scheduled this summer, unlike last year, which is a huge thing for us. It's where we really get a chance to engage and bring together members. Each individual chapter hosts events throughout the summer. Typically, there's often a large mountain bike festival statewide that brings folks from all corners of the state. So the ability to actually get out and meet and enjoy each other's company sort of in closer quarters outside is a huge thing, and one that I know folks, just as I've talked and ran into folks across the state on trails, everybody's really excited about that. The idea of where they don't have to, you know, stay in their car, jet out and ride on the trail and then kind of, you know, leave as quickly as they can, which has been the guidance that we've supported and really encouraged folks over the last year. But that idea that you can sit around at a trailhead, talk with your friends afterwards, meet new people, that's a huge part of the sport as well, is that idea of just making friends and engaging socially.
Nick Bennett is the executive director of the Vermont Mountain Biking Association, or VIMBA. The website address is vmba.org. Nick, thanks so much for being on the program this morning.
Always a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
All right. Have fun out there. We're going to take a break now for CBS News. And when we come back, we're going to honor the memory of M. Dickey Drysdale. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. Vermont and Vermont media lost an icon a few weeks ago with the passing of M. Dickey Drysdale, a longtime editor and publisher of the Herald of Randolph. Dickey worked at the Herald for 44 years, eventually taking over the reins from his father, Jack. In addition to working at the Herald, he was treasurer of the Vermont Press Association for 25 years. He served as president of the Randolph Chamber of Commerce and the Randolph Rotary Club. Dickey was inducted into the New England Newspaper and Press Association's Hall of Fame in 2015. And listeners We'd love to hear your memories of this man who meant so much to his community. You can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Here to share memories and stories of Dickie Drysdale is someone who worked with him for a long time, knew him well. Bob Eddy is photographer for the White River Valley Herald. Bob, thanks for being with us this morning.
Great to be with you, Rick. Looking forward to this conversation and looking forward to hearing what friends and people around the state have to share about Dickie this morning with us.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, Bob, tell us about your background with the Herald.
Well, I came to work with Dickie in 1987. I knew Margie Belgoyan. I sang in the choir with her. Kathy, my wife, and I sang in the choir with her at Middlebury long before she ever caught Dickie's eye. Margie's probably the best soprano in Vermont for many, many decades. And Dickie was wise enough to, when he sang in a chorus with her, down in Hanover, he was wise enough to bring her back to Randolph, and they are were he reckoned with in music circles and in many circles over the years. But I knew Dickie upon coming to Randolph in 76 and joined the staff at the Herald in 87 and worked with him for many, many years. Dear man, great man, one of the finest people I've ever known.
Bob, do you remember the first time that you met Dickie and what your impressions were?
Yeah, he came to a church supper at Bethany Church and sat with us at the head table. And Dickie grew up in the church, and I thought, this is a powerful man. I mean, this is a man who grew up in Randolph in a time, came to Randolph before the end of the Second World War when he was just six months old with his mom and dad, who came to run the Herald in Randolph. From a newspaper background in Western Massachusetts, and Dickie struck me as I knew he was a Harvard graduate, and I expected to meet this guy who would be something of a pretty full of himself, and he was totally disarming. Never more interested in himself than he was interested in anyone and everything. He was always out there learning and trying to get to know people better. Can I share one poem that he wrote?
Oh, absolutely. Please.
This is an example of the kind of person Dickie was. He loved he noticed the small little details in life. He wrote a poem about Bill Burgess, who was the town manager of Randolph. And I'll share, this says a lot about Dickie, because what you admire in someone else is something that is probably true about yourself.
True.
Bill Burgess was a great town manager. I could see that when I visited with him down at the landfill. And some contractor came up and had every sort of thing to say about every sort of thing, and none of it good. But Bill wouldn't answer a peep. Not for the longest time. He chewed on that big cigar and let the smoke circle above his head, and he just laid his eyes on Mr. Contractor, who raved and argued and maybe had time to listen to himself a little bit. And then, in the slowest drawl imaginable, Bill made one observation or another, something about greater mechanics or the lateness of the summer, and maybe a smidgen that was related to that contract, or maybe not. Nothing was resolved. But when Mr. Contractor clambered back into his pickup, you could see he was well satisfied. And that's Dickie. I mean, Dickie was a listener. Mm-hmm. He had very little to say about himself.
Yeah.
He wanted to know about you and about your story. And that's the person I met at that church dinner that night. Just a fascinating individual and wonderful person to be around. Whether you were skiing with him on back trails, he was a wonderful skier. Probably the finest skier I've ever known. Just a second, I'm going to turn this off.
All right.
Yeah, I'm going to throw this phone into the other room.
Well done. All right, Bob. While you're okay. Doing that, hey, let's go to the phones. We have a call from Chris joining us from Colorado. Hi, Chris. How are you?
Hi. How are you both, Bob Eddy? It is so great to hear your voice. How are you,
Bob? You still with us?
I am.
Oh, okay.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead. All right, Chris, go right ahead.
Hey, thank you so much. I moved to Randolph in 2004, taking a position at Vermont Tech, and moved away from Randolph to Trinidad, Colorado in 2018. And in those years, I have so many great memories of Dickie Drysdale, not just collaborating on things at the Herald, but mostly as a musician and choir director. Dickie Drysdale carried an energy with him to the stage of the Chandler, to Bethany Church, and so many other places. I am just honored to have sung next to him as a tenor, as a baritone, in his choirs and in choirs with him. Bob can speak to that as well. We sang quite loudly, didn't we, Bob?
Sometimes well, but always loudly.
Oh, that's beautiful. Chris, thank you so much for sharing that.
Absolutely. Best to all, and thank you again for this program.
Sure. Thanks for listening from Trinidad, Colorado. Thanks, Chris. Wow. So I know music was an important part of his life, Bob. Tell us about that.
Well, Dickie was raised in Randolph, and one of his first instructors was Florence Shoal Cushman on piano. Florence was a force to be reckoned with. She was also the teacher of Nico Muhly, one of the great composers in the world today, who summered in Randolph. But Dickie matured as a musician under the tutelage later in life of Harold Luce, fiddler of great note in Chelsea, Vermont. Dickie played the fiddle. Dickie played the saw.
He could play
tunes just squeezing his hands together that would make a dog's hair curl from 50 yards away. I mean, he was just an amazing musician. You could see that in so many ways. Wonderful tenor voice, wonderful to sing next to him.
You know, when you read that poem, I could hear him, reciting it. I could almost hear him just saying that, just telling the story. He was able to write in the way he spoke, in the way he would tell a story. It was such a gift of his, right, to have that. I don't want to call it folksy, but just so wonderfully straightforward and honest approach to writing, not only in the paper but in his poems.
Oh yeah, well that becomes true of Dickie in so many ways. It was said by Howard Frank Mosier, wrote about him. He said this is a lovely written memoir. He spoke of Dickie's Vermont moments. It's the best and most authentic book I've ever read about life in a rural Vermont village. That sense of the moment and the clarity of thought is never more evident in an essay that he wrote in Vermont Memories called How Not to Do It. And I'm just going to read a few of these. All things right. You might not know if you've never tried canoeing on the White River without quite knowing what you were doing. These are all numbered. I'm not going to read the numbers because I'm going to skip through.
Okay.
There's a lot more water in there than you think. However, there's not quite enough water to cover the rocks. There are a lot more rocks in there than you think. Shouting at the canoe will not make it turn to avoid the rocks. Sometimes the presence of a rock is indicated only by the thump on the bow of your canoe. Ooh. Canoe paddles can move right along downstream all by themselves. An overturned canoe wedged against rock with the current flowing into it weighs several tons. Pat Kennedy over in Chelsea has a power winch that is about the only thing that will get you wedge canoe out. So it's the moving to the note of specificity that makes that essay just such yes. ring with such clarity. And Dickie wrote about that way all the time.
You know, Bob, I spoke with him several times on the phone. I met him just once. I was doing a special piece on Route 66. And my impression was sitting down with him in that wonderful home that is, you know, the office of the Herald of Randolph, now the White River Valley Herald. He was less comfortable speaking about himself than he was about the paper, the people who worked there, the town. You know, if he was happier to tell me about an intern who's gone on to great things working with VT Digger, Katie Jickling, who was an intern there, than he was when I would ask him about himself.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You couldn't be more true when you say that. This is the Herald did a wonderful tribute of him under Tim Calabro. Dickey was only fourth editor of the Herald in 100 and when he came aboard in 1971. There had never been a Democratic senator from Vermont. We had it was a different time,
yeah.
And we were still pasting up the paper back then. And Nancy Cassidy, who started working with Dickey's dad, Jack, back before Dickey was even working for the paper, and is still with Tim Calabro now at the paper 5 years after Dickey's departure. Nancy wrote this in the Herald, where Dickey was remembered as our friend. Many people wrote on this page, and she wrote, "We were a family. We all knew our jobs and worked hard together, especially on Wednesday when we all struggled to get the paste-up layouts done before the print deadline." And this is vintage Drysdale. "Envy had the biggest pair of scissors and always cutting off something I thought we needed." I remember when he bought a new waxer for Herald copy, he ran a yardstick through it soon after he bought it just to see if the yardstick would stick to the wall. The waxer never worked really well after that.
Oh, boy. Bob, tell us about – you mentioned that Dickey wrote poetry, but tell us about his relationship with poets.
Oh, well, it's interesting that he didn't generally publish poetry in the Herald. Rick, he didn't think that it was the proper place for poetry generally, but he made an exception in the case of David Budbill, because you can tell a lot about a person by the way they heat, and he and Budbill both had woodlots. They cut their own wood, they heated with wood. And it was something Dickey, by the way, was that every March would sugar in the backyard on a little backyard boiler out under the open sky. And the boys, Robin and Jamie, were back again this March for a full month, as Dickey was the lights were dimming for him. But the boys were home, and David was loved by Dickey, and after he came out with Jude Vine, Dickey really admired that, wrote about it, and then he ended up writing about David in his poetry book, an amazing little piece entitled "November: An Appreciation of David Budbill." And David had a certain dour side to him that I think Dickey really appreciated. Dickey would take weather any way it came, and he wrote this in appreciation of David. "November galloped into town today on a gale, slinging a vile ovation, brew of cold rain, snow, and Lilliputian darts that sought out your face and then danced away to the pavement. All day, customers lunged through our door, out of the dishwasher gray, gasping with bitter recollection of November's past. Later, I stood amid swaying hulks in the maple woods and smiled. A thank you to you, David, for my satisfaction and the certainty that it will only get worse." So, Dickey was fond of saying that if you're considering going for a hike, no matter, you know, you in Vermont, when you plan on a hike with family, you're probably planning a couple weeks ahead, and then the day comes and the weather looks iffy and there's yard work to be done, and he developed a philosophy very early on of go anyway. He said, "Over the years, the rule has cropped up as consistently as bedrock on a mountain ridge. If bad weather or an awkward schedule intervened, I wavered. But whenever I went hiking anyway, I was glad of it. And every time I stayed home, I wished I hadn't. slowly the rule solidified in my mind. You see, I had the rule. Go anyway. Go anyway. It'll be fine. Wow. See, he was a very passionate, positive voice for pursuing those goals and objectives, whether they be in community or on a simple day hike, that would get you out there and doing the business of helping to make community, experience life to the fullest, and then make community, help communities to work and to be well. He was a very positive force, a very, very much an optimist.
Bob, what kind of a boss was he?
Funny as hell. it was said, Tom Wicker was a real close friend. Tom Winship was a close friend, had a summer place. Tom Winship was, of course, the editor of the Boston Globe. For 17 years, won 17 Pulitzer Prizes with the Globe, and once said of his friend Dickie, and really thinking about Dickie and so many other weekly newspaper editors around the state, Vermont is a state of weak daily newspapers and strong weekly newspapers. And Dickie loved great writing and loved the look of a good photograph. But he was a teacher. He was willing to bring people up through the ranks. And Lord knows he worked with me. And so many hires, Sandy Vondrasek Cooch, Tim Calabro, these were people that Dickie brought into the paper and nourished them and brought them up as writers. He didn't bring many established people onto the ranks of the Herald. They learned the craft, they learned the trade under his tutelage, and he was a great teacher, very tolerant man, and a very funny dude. One of his famous antics was to he had size 14 shoes, and you'd never know it from the way he skied. But one of the things he would always do is coming down the stairs at the Herald. More often than not, he would pretend to fall and scare the bejesus out of anybody who was on the first floor, because he would come thundering down those stairs as if he was in full fall. And so he wrote a poem about falling. Rick, this guy was a great writer. I mean, he was a government major, political science major at Harvard, and got his master's in government management, government from Pittsburgh, before he went into journalism, taking over the family business. But he wrote about he wrote better than anybody else I've ever read. In Vermont. And this is one poem that he wrote about falling of a different sort. It's entitled The Fall Line. And just listen to this writing. The fall line at Mad River Glen ski area is one of just a few ski trails in Vermont you have to climb up to. That 20-foot vertical feat of sidestepping above the famous single chairlift constitutes a rite of passage, a toll payment that admits you to the most beautiful ski trail in Vermont. Even before you start down, you're enchanted by the wandering, narrow passageways between snow-laden spruces that can lead to a glimpse of Lake Champlain. There's a sense of having entered a sort of throne room for the privileged skier. That sense is, of course, heightened by the slight knot in your stomach as you contemplate the gladed steeps beyond. This is the realm of the sublime, where beauty and danger dwell together. The fall line has admitted you to its magic kingdom. But now you have to get down the mountain all by yourself.
What a beautiful ode to Vermont.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
Well,
now, he was kind of like a cairn above tree line, you know, those rock piles that you see that show right. You that you're on the right path.
Yeah.
There are no other ways to find your way. When you were on the right path, Dickie was really, really, his compass was true. And, he was a force for positive direction, in his community comments as a newspaper editor, on his observations and his conducting. He was the conductor of the Randolph Singers for most of the life of the Singers. I mean, he conducted at the 50th anniversary of the Singers, and he started conducting the Singers so long ago that most people thought he founded it. He came in shortly after it started. And what a wonderful person to be in the presence of.
We're almost out of time, Bob. The M stood for, was it Maurice or Morris? Did anyone ever call him that?
No. And woe to you if you did.
I thought so.
He went by Dickey, which is his mother's maiden name, D-I-C-K-E-Y.
Yeah.
Or he went by Dick. And the people who knew him perhaps best called him Poppy, Pops, or Butch. That was his childhood nickname, and there were a few very privileged folks who got to call him that. Mm-hmm.
All right, and we're almost out of time, but you mentioned that he could have gone on to work, you know, in other areas. He took over the family business. Did he ever resent or regret that decision?
I never had the sense that he did. He was a North Star for many Vermont politicians and community leaders from the heyday of, I mean, he was at the Herald before Leahy was in the Senate.
Mm, right.
Dean C. Davis was government when he started at the Herald, and Winston Prouty and George Aiken were in the Senate. And he was listened to around the state by local community leaders and by community leaders in the Vermont politics and by leaders nationally. He was a close friend of Dick Mallory's. These people looked to him for his wisdom, and
Bob,
he was
we're gonna have to
a
leave
great
it.
Giver of it.
Oh, thank you so much, Bob. We're going to leave it right there. Bob Eddy, White River Valley Herald photographer, and thank you for sharing your remembrances of M. Dickey Drysdale this morning. Dickey was the longtime editor and publisher of the Herald of Randolph. He died on April 28th at the age of 76. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. At the beginning of today's show, I mentioned how I never tire of the accessibility that we have our state politicians. One more thing that I still marvel at is another aspect of the Vermont way, and that's the kindness of Vermonters always looking for ways to help one another. I just learned about a group called Community Harvest of Central Vermont and knew I had to have them come on and share their story here on Vermont Viewpoint. Joining me now to let us know what they're all about is their executive director, Allison Levin. Allison, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Great. Thank you so much, Rick.
You're welcome. And listeners, to ask a question about Community Harvest of Central Vermont, or you can let us know if you've seen their work in action, you can call us at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. Allison, what is Community Harvest of Central Vermont?
We are one of the regional gleaning programs around Vermont. We focus our work here in Washington and northern Orange counties, and we're really a group of Central Vermonters who are committed to bringing our community together through gleaning to recover surplus food produced on area farms to feed those with limited access to fresh local food, and in the process help the community to gain a greater awareness and appreciation of the local food system, healthy eating, and waste reduction. And it's all sort of based around gleaning.
When and why did the organization get started?
Well, I started the organization in 2014 out of some preliminary efforts that Local Food Pantry in Montpelier put out and said, hey, we know there's food out in the fields, and, you know, we know that people on the food shelves really could use that food. And I volunteered for that effort and soon realized there was a lot more potential there with a lot more food available, and it needed a lot of coordination to make the pieces all fall into place.
For people who aren't familiar with it, explain what gleaning is.
Well, sort of the most bare bones example or sort of way you look at it is really just going out into farmers' fields and collecting what's left at the end. So you're gleaning, the stuff that's still good that might be left over, and you can use gleaning in other speech that you might use. You glean information from a document or
right.
anything like that. So it's really getting that food, and it really goes back to biblical times when food was left actually in the fields for the poor to have a share of it.
What does it take to glean a field?
A lot of coordination, and depending on how big, potentially many hands.
And why would this food otherwise be left in the field?
There's a lot of different reasons. Farmers are, obviously focused on selling what they can, and they want to make sure they have plenty for whatever markets they might have. So they are always going to plant a little bit more because you never know when a crop is going to do well or not. And then, so they might just have extra of something. If it does really well, then they're going to have a lot of it. And then there's other times when they, that crop doesn't quite match the market demand. So that maybe the cabbage is a little too small or a little too big or imperfect. Maybe they have some bug bites in some of the leaves of some kale or something like that. So just really a range of reasons still why that nutritious food might still be in the field. And the farmers put a lot of energy into growing that. So it seems logical that we try to use that and eat that versus having it go to waste.
Allison, how do you find the farmers who are willing to let your group come in and glean their field?
We over time, they hear about us. We reach out to them and let them know how we can serve their farm. There's a lot of different ways that we can serve their operation. It's not just going out into the fields and harvesting what might be left over. We can also just stop at their farm and pick up things that they might have sorted out that they were not selling when they were washing their carrots or whatever it might be, or after the farmer's market on Saturdays or after a CSA distribution, they may still have some left over that they don't want to have go to waste.
Is there an advantage to having those vegetables removed from a field before, they go to plant next year's crop?
Sometimes, yes, actually. In particular, I think of orchards. They don't want to have those apples left on the ground because it attracts pests and disease. Mm-hmm. Other times in the fields, you have crops where we actually go in and help maintain the crops. We take off some of the older leaves so that the new leaves can grow, and then that farmer can harvest and sell those. So it's definitely pest and disease management is part of the food. But there's other times when, food could stay out in the field. It could, turn into new soil. But that farmer's already put a lot of energy, whether it's fossil fuels or water or the cost for seed into those products. And it seems a waste to let that just go into the soil when we could be eating it.
I'm speaking with Allison Levin. She's the executive director of Community Harvest of Central Vermont, and they do a lot of gleaning. So does the gleaning happen just in the fall, Allison?
That's the primary time or when it's the most busy. But now after this is our eighth season, we're starting to pretty much be gleaning year-round. We don't go out into the field every single month of the year, but this last year we were out in November and December, and then this spring we were in some of the local farms' greenhouses in April and May. So we're pretty much gleaning every month, but if we're not in the fields, we're picking up from the farmers' storehouses as they sort through things, and then we're getting things, from other partners as well, bread and other sources.
Mm. What types of produce are you able to glean?
We glean 40 to 50 different kinds of produce from local farms, anywhere from apples and berries, which are obviously fruit is really popular, but we are gleaning pretty much anything they have to offer, anything from Jerusalem artichokes to, your typical corn and carrots and peas and the crops that people are most excited about. So it just really ranges. It's an opportunity for the sites we donate to experience a lot of different crops. You know, you're not everyone's familiar with kohlrabi, for example.
My mom is, or was. She loved kohlrabi, so you hit a chord there. In a typical year, how much food does your group collect?
Well, it's a little hard to remember since the last year or so hasn't been typical.
Okay.
But just looking at my numbers on the wall here, since we started, you know, the first couple years was like 30,000 pounds. And then, you know, we were up to 50,000. This last year, it was 100. And let's see, what we got from the field was about 75,000 pounds. And then this last year, we did a lot of additional work to help get food to those who really needed it most. And so in total last year, we donated 138,000 pounds.
Wow. You've got to be proud of that work.
Some days I remember to be.
Well done. Allison, why do you think the work your group is doing is important?
Well, I just hate to see good, nutritious food that our farmers have grown go to waste. And the logical result of what do you do with that food is addressing food insecurity and hunger in our community, which we all know is very prevalent at the moment, more so than ever before. And it's a very logical progression in what you would do with that food. I grew up on an organic farm, and so that's just what you do is you make sure that that food gets utilized.
Mm. What do you do with the food that you glean from Vermont farm fields?
So we work with now 30 nonprofits here in central Vermont, mostly Washington County, who are feeding people with limited access to fresh local food. So that might be one of the many food shelves that we're partnering with, the senior meal programs, places like Another Way or shelters like Good Samaritan Haven, and early childhood programs or after-school programs, all serving individuals who don't always have the means or access to the food that's being grown right here in our community.
Who are the people who help with the gleaning and transporting of the food to those in need?
So we have a very small staff, and then we really rely on many, many volunteers. Last year we worked with over 260 volunteers, which was actually more than we ever worked with before, if you exclude the big school groups that we would normally have, which weren't possible last year. And those volunteers help us with all the different aspects of the organization, from actually going out in the fields and doing the physical harvesting to helping deliver it, helping before we deliver it, getting it ready, weighing and labeling it and tracking it so we can give farmers credit for their donations. And helping with all the different pieces in between, whether it's data entry or putting up posters. Anyone that wants to get involved, there's some way for them to do that.
Well, how can someone get involved?
So if you want to volunteer, we encourage people to visit our website and register as a volunteer at communityharvestvt.org. And once you've registered, then you'll get invitations to all the opportunities that we have available for volunteers. And if volunteering isn't your thing, you can always join our mailing list and contribute financially, become a business sponsor, or help us think about what our next steps are for future expansion.
Really impressed that you had 260 volunteers last year. That website address, again, is communityharvestvt.org. How are you funded, Allison?
We are funded. We try to really spread it out and have everyone contribute in different ways that they can. So primarily individual contributors. We have a lot of new sustaining donors that really make our work possible. Then we also have local towns contribute. We have some grants that we receive that we apply for, as well as right now we're reaching out to a lot of businesses to sponsor particular weeks that we're gleaning, and we'll publicize their contribution that way. So anyone that wants to contribute and get involved, there's a lot of different ways they can do that.
How about a farmer? How can a farmer become part of Community Harvest?
Basically, we're on call 24/7. So if they figure out how to reach us, then we're able to check in with them and see how best we can serve them and figure out what they have is something that our sites can utilize, which 99% of the time it is. And we can make sure that we send a volunteer or staff to come and get it as soon as possible so it doesn't go bad.
Well, in addition to having all those volunteers, it's very impressive the partnerships that you've created since founding 7 years ago. I know you can't name them all, but I do want you to run through the types of partnerships that you have. And first, your farm and food donor partners.
Yeah, so we have many farms. Some are really large farms like Bear Roots Farm and Dog River Farm is how we got started. And then we have other food donors like Red Hen Baking and other businesses who are contributing and know the importance of the work that we're doing and helping them get the food that they can't sell to those who need it. And then obviously we have our recipient partners who are the organizations that are, you know, actually working with individuals. We're just sort of the in-between from, you know, connecting all the dots in the food system. And then obviously we have the businesses and other community partners that we work with in different ways. So between, you know, the 40-some businesses who donate, whether it's farms or individuals or other businesses, and then the 30 organizations that we donate the food to, plus many other nonprofits and organizations that we partner with in the community, you know, it's quite a few organizations that we juggle and work to serve in the community, and we just sort of work to be a connector between all of them to help everyone understand where the needs are and how everyone can best serve those needs.
And I am impressed by the number of different organizations and types of organizations that you provide for. So tell us about some of them. I mean, it ranges from food shelves to farm to school partners.
Yeah, so, you know, we are serving places like Capstone or Montpelier Food Pantry. Many people have heard of those if they're in the area. And then we also work with a lot of schools and do have a number of farm-to-school partnerships. So, you know, some of the kids in, you know, elementary or middle or high school don't necessarily have a garden and aren't necessarily familiar with that kohlrabi that your mom loves. And so we try to engage those students with some of this Glean food. Sometimes we can bring them out to Glean, but a lot of times we actually send the food right to the classroom and let those students experience that kohlrabi firsthand. And so each time we send them a box to their classroom, that's a different kind of produce. We call them mystery boxes. And those boxes give those kids a chance to learn about local food. And so when they see it in the supermarket, they're going to tell their mom that they actually like beets and they want their mom to buy them for them.
Wow, that's pretty impressive. And then how are community partners involved?
So community partners, there's a number of different ways. But, you know, as I said, we work with a lot of organizations around the Hunger Council of Washington County, a number of, I'm trying to think of all the different players that we partner with, all the businesses that help sponsor our work. Was there a group in particular that you were thinking of?
No, that was just more of a general question. I know you also have funding sponsors, and these are people who step up and help fund what you do.
Yeah, the business sponsors, we offer them, you know, either a week of gleaning to sponsor, and when we email out to all those volunteers to ask them to come help glean with us, we publicize that business for that week that they're sponsoring. So for at the $250 level, a business can sponsor a week of gleaning, and we'll send that out to the 1,000 volunteers that we're reaching out to for those that glean or that week or two of gleaning.
Allison, what is the Vermont Gleaning Collective?
Yeah, thanks for asking, Rick. So the collective is a broader network of gleaning organizations around Vermont. We are a member of that collective, and there are like 7 or 8, keeps changing, so I can't remember now how many, but organizations all over Vermont that are doing gleaning work. So we're just one of many organizations throughout the state. We're focused in this area, and then, you know, Salvation Farms and Lamoille Valley Gleaning is in Lamoille, and in Addison County there's a Hope program, and Willing Hands and Interveil have programs all around Vermont doing the same kind of work that we're doing. Each program is a little different, but we really coordinate, and so sometimes one of those other programs will have extra food that we will go and get from them, or vice versa. So if we have extra here in Washington County, we'll share that around the state. So we really work to coordinate and professionalize the work that we're doing so we can really provide the best service possible to recipients, the farms, and the best experience for those volunteers as well.
And if another gleaning operation was short on help, would you also rally to kind of help them where they have a big crop of kale that needs to be picked?
Yeah, we do share in all regards, whether it's just this last year learning how to change our protocols to make it safe for everyone to go out and figuring out what our best practices were, or, you know, when there's last year there was in Jericho, there was a huge amount of beets. There was thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds of beets, and we coordinated with all the programs, and everyone got some of those beets. We went out and harvested the most of them and sent them to some of the programs that couldn't come, and then other programs joined us, and we got all those beets, and we are just finishing sending them out right now, actually.
The 2021 beet explosion of Jericho. See, I missed that story. That would have been a great one, but that's fantastic to hear about. So you mentioned some of the protocols, how they changed during the pandemic. What kind of things did you have to be concerned with?
Well, luckily, we do a lot of our work outside, so that made it a lot easier. But we were obviously, you know, all the volunteers were wearing face coverings, and we're doing a lot more hand sanitizing and cleaning of things early on. And so we just had to make sure that all the volunteers that came out felt really safe, and they wanted to continue helping and working with us. And luckily, we were able to do that and glean twice what we had done in previous years. And we haven't really stopped. This year we've already done way more than we did last year at this time. So,
wow. So what do you have coming up that you'll need help with in the next month or so?
Well, we're going to start. It starts off a little quiet at this time of year, but we still have volunteers that are delivering for us. We have posters that we're hanging up to encourage other volunteers to join us. And then we'll start having field gleans and other activities, market gleaning in June and July. We'll start being busy. So if people want to get involved, now is a great time to register. And then as soon as those opportunities come along, they can join us. So, yeah, we're this year, as I was saying, we've already donated 50,000 pounds. That's compared to about 14,000 pounds last year about at this time. And in a normal year before the pandemic, it was about 5,000 pounds. So, yeah, we've been a little busy.
That's fantastic. It's better than not being busy, right, Allison?
I think so, yes.
Excellent. All right. Allison Levin is the Executive Director of Community Harvest of Central Vermont. Listeners, you can learn more. The website is communityharvestvt.org. Allison, thanks so much for the work you're doing. Thanks to your volunteers, and thank you for being on Vermont Viewpoint this morning.
Thank you so much, Rick.
All right, really enjoyed it. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Shayla Connor Shapiro, directed by Danny McGivergan. And you can email us, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Love to get your feedback about what you're hearing. Also, if you've got suggestions for guests or topics, please send them our way. It's very helpful to know what you'd like to hear on the show. You can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast. That's at wdevradio.com. It's Monday, so that means we've got Bill Sayre and Common Sense Radio coming up next, then the Midday News Service at noon, and then 3 beautiful hours of Greg Hooker and The Getaway from 1 to 4 this afternoon. I'm Rick Sengary. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.